Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. Bristol Community FM. We're back on BCFM around about mid-April 2016, every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Barry Wynn is one of the people that started ITV ABC Television in London back in the 1950s, and his father helped Wynn and Alamein help Monty. Also, Lawrence Harrowell from Surrey, who's just come back from Colombia, and Jackie Cannon, another Latin from Cuba. Actually, she's from the UK, but she's back in Cuba as much as she can be. Dialects produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
This is Barry Wynn here. I'm a sometime author, and because of my age, which is no secret, I'm 87, I was at a very formative time in my life when the Second World War began in 1939, when I was in fact 10 years old. My father had joined up in 1939, and we didn't see him for about 4 years. So before he left, he took his family down to Devon, where he thought it would be safe. And it was only 23 miles from Plymouth, and I actually watched Plymouth on fire when all the oil tanks were hit by the Germans. So I didn't see my father for a long time, and eventually he was in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and he became Assistant Director of Supplies for Montgomery when he was made the Operation Commander under Alexander for the 8th Army.
Tell us a bit about Montgomery. Was he seen as a bit of a new broom at the time?
Well, there are one or two very interesting things, I think, about that situation. In North Africa, we had some brilliant generals, Wavell, Allenby and people like that, but lack of supplies, everything difficult, huge areas to cover, and they needed, Churchill needed, and guided by Alan Brooke, needed a new team out there, because we were basically in a very powerless state from morale. Everybody was depressed, been beaten many times, but they were pretty brilliant in what they did, because they didn't have enough men and didn't have the right equipment, and the German equipment was far superior to ours. So Churchill, on the advice from his military people, said, we've got to have a new team. They decided to appoint Alexander as the GOC, and they, in fact, then appointed a man called Gott to be the field commander. But he was killed within 3 weeks of being appointed. So there was another crisis. Who on earth do we replace that key position? And Allenbrooke said, there is one man we've got to do. There's only one man to do this, Montgomery. Now, the interesting thing to me, because after all, I was very young then, was that the two commanders now appointed had both been battalion commanders in the First World War. They knew better than anybody else what we were up against with the German army. More efficient, ruthless in their way, and that something special would be needed to do this. And Montgomery said, yes, well, I will accept the task, but only on one condition. I'm not prepared to start an attack or do anything else until I am given the right number of men, the right number of units, the support of the Royal Air Force, and the supplies. And if I say I want 10,000 shells of so-and-so, I shall require 30,000. If you do that for me, I will give you victory. That's basically what he said. And Churchill said, I agree with you. Okay. That's what we would do. So my father was on the supply field. It was terrifically difficult to send all these supplies right across the Atlantic to escape from the U-boats, down the coast, the east coast of America, down through South America, then across to Africa, then up the other side of Africa. Everything had to come in this huge distance, being harassed by U-boats all the way. So the supply situation was absolutely extraordinary. And I remember in my book, A King Shilling, that my father said 500 lorry loads of food and supplies would be gone in one day to keep the army going. And thousands of miles of desert highways, Stuka bombers and heaven knows what. And of course, the Battle of Alamein, and another very interesting thing, it was the last defence before Egypt. Now, when Alexander took over and Montgomery, Alexander was sort of an aristocratic man, always perfectly turned out. He was the epitome of the British officer, charming, perfectly dressed and everything else. You could underestimate him, but he would delegate everything to Montgomery. So the thing is this, here we had the backs to the wall. There was the Suez Canal, only a few miles away. This new team comes in. Morale of the British Army was at the lowest possible ebb. We thought we were going to be defeated because Rommel, the brilliant general that he was, thought, right, we're right on top of this, break through the Suez Canal, we then get the oil. We then go further east and we will attack the Russians from the rear through the Crimea. That would have been fatal. So they had to be stopped at the last point. So when Montgomery came, he didn't choose that position. The position was already chosen. But when Alexander went into the headquarters of Africa, he saw all his key officers, brigadiers, colonels and generals and one thing or another, working on papers and this and that, and they were a furious intent. And he sort of, being a new broom, said, well, what are you working on? They said, well, we're working on for when we're going to go the other side of the Suez Canal and use that as our last defence. Alexander said, gentlemen, tear up those papers. There is no further defeat. There is no further retreat. We will stand here and die if it's necessary. Do you understand? Well, within 3 weeks, they say, the whole morale of the Eighth Army changed. It was the right thing to do at the time. So in other words, no more retreat. Wonderful position we were in. Now how do we deal with this? How do we defeat Rommel? And that is really what happened. And the main thing was the equipment and the supplies. The wonderful people we had there. I mean, we talk now about Scotland. The most wonderful fighting men to have beside you. You don't have to worry whether they'd still be there. The New Zealanders were excellent. And the Australians. And the Indians. We were all there. But now everybody knew. Right. Apparently this is the end. So we better damn well do something about it. And that to me is a, you know, I still think, I mean, it wasn't the biggest battle by long shot. I mean, the Russians took far more trouble. They had, you know, battles with 3,000 tanks at a time. I mean, dreadful things. But the pivotal change, really, was Alamein. And it was the last battle in which we didn't have the Americans. We did it as the British Empire. And, of course, it was successful. And Churchill was so nervous about it. But when they finally said, yes, we've done it, he wanted to be absolutely certain before he gave the order, ring out the bells of England.
How did they get the supplies? You're saying round, was it actually round Africa?
They had to go first across to America to get to miss the U-boats by going in the north, right across to America, then go down the east coast of America where we'd get protection from the American Air Force and anything else like that and their own home fleet, then cross from the South Atlantic to Africa, go past that, up to the Red Sea and right up to Clara. It's a terrific way. My father told me that it took 3 months. Just 3 months to get there.
I wonder if we've got enough ships today to do that. I don't think so.
No, not at all. We haven't. You know, what have we got now?
Tell us a bit about your introduction to the army and your role then.
Well, I'm totally insignificant. The war had finished with victory. I had worked for 3 years in a wartime, 2 years in a wartime factory on the Great West Road. That was during the latter part of the war, when Hitler started launching the V1s and V2s. What actually happened was that our family, when my father was wounded at the Battle of Marath, and he was medically discharged, he came back. But unfortunately, he always said he had more trouble with his son and his children than he ever had with the German army. We were uncontrollable. I think he was right, probably. But anyway, he was a very kind man, but he didn't know how to deal with this people who'd never been under his control, really, since the war. And so we had a difficult relationship. But when he went back, actually it was to Harpenden in Hertfordshire, where we sort of ended up for the latter part of the war with Guardians. He then said, well, now there are two of us looking for jobs. That's me. I'm out of discharge now. I've got to find a job. And Barry, you want to leave school? I said, I do. And he said, right. A big argument at the breakfast table. And he said, I was 15. Just before 15, he said, Barry, you will go into Luton tomorrow on your bicycle, and if you can find a job within 1 day, you may leave school. He knew, of course, that was impossible. I said, right. So at dawn, I'm on my bicycle, no traffic in those days, no petrol, and I go to Luton. I try all the normal places that one goes to. No luck at all. I spent the whole day. I knew that the colonel from the 8th Army, X, had won the battle. And then as I was very, very tired and dispirited, no lunch or anything like that, I was starting to cycle out, and I happened to turn to the left and I saw an old-fashioned kind of house of 200 years old, and it said, Lad Wanted. So I stopped. And I put the pedal on the bike, on the pedal on the curb, and I went in. I had to go to the very top. And on the outside was a sign with top hats, silk top hats, you see. So I went up slowly to the very top. There was a door. I knocked on the door, come in. And there were three old men. I don't think they were less than 80 each, with a table. They were sitting side by side making silk hats. Yes, lad, what do you want? And I said, I believe you've got a job, sir. Oh, yes. Do you know what we do? I think you make hats, sir. Silk hats, lad. Would you like to make silk hats? Oh, I'd love to make silk hats, sir. They looked at me and they started talking to each other, you see. Obviously, boys were not easy to find, and eventually the oldest one said, right, well, start at 8 o'clock on Monday, £1 a week. So I was so overjoyed, I get onto my bike, and I pedal the way back. And of course, when I got back to our flat there, my father was there, Davina, my sister, and my other brother and sister. They were all there looking anxiously because this was a huge moment in the family of crisis, you see. And there was my father reading the Times, pretending to read the Times, I think, you see. And when I walked in, he said, your lunch is in the oven, Barry. Oh, thank you so much. So I went to get my thing, put it down on the table. They're all looking, the family, at me, you see. I decided to play it cool because this was a total victory for me over Montgomery's chief of supplies, you see. So eventually, with no, I'm not helping in any way at all. I was very naughty, you see. And he said, are we permitted to ask you whether you've been successful in getting a job? Yes, I am. I'm starting on Monday. My father then sort of gulped and then said, And what is that job to be, may I ask? I said, I'm going to make silk hats. There was an explosion, would have been devastating even at Alamein. The roof nearly went off the top. He said, no son of mine is ever going to go into the drapery business. What are you talking about? But he said, you've made your point. You may leave school now. And that's when I went into a wartime factory on the Great West Road and was blown up by one of Hitler's V2 rockets. So I consider myself to be one of the first victims of an intercontinental missile.
What were you doing there?
It was a factory, French factory, actually. The name isn't well known now, but they were perfumers. Coty was the name. Wonderful company. And my father had used influence with the managing director because he'd been in the retail business before the war. And he talked to them and they said, OK, well, we'll put him through every department in the factory of making perfumes, lipsticks, creams and what have you. And we will give him a thorough training and then send him up to the head office to learn about sales and things like that. And that's what I did.
So your father didn't want you making hats, but he was fine about you making perfume?
Apparently so, yes. I think he had an eye for the girls and therefore, you know, this took us into a rather sort of upmarket area.
Take us through that V2 experience, though, because I think at the time, although probably the general population didn't know this, certainly at the highest levels, there were worries that that there might be an atom bomb on the end of one of these V2s, because certainly at the top level at the time, Churchill was very nervous about the possibility of one of these things having an atom bomb on it, because both the Americans and the British, if I can say both, no, the Americans, the British and the Nazis had been working on the possibility of an atomic bomb.
Yeah, well, that is true. But I don't think we ever, never did I hear of the talk that there might be an atom bomb. That was at the top level. We knew that they were working on it. And therefore, the average person didn't know anything about it. The first thing that happened were the doodlebug that was called in those days, with a little engine on the back. Very, very hit and miss sort of situation. They were the first ones. Then suddenly the rockets arrived with the doodlebug. You could hear it, and it had a rather bad morale effect in a way, but you hear pop, 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 pop. And suddenly the popping stopped. And if you could hear the pop, that you'd heard the sound and then it had stopped, then you knew it was coming down fairly near you. And then there was the very, very considerable experience. But with the V2, it was totally different. You didn't hear anything. And it was an interesting thing in our factory, because it was originally a perfume factory, but now making foot powder for American troops and various other wartime stuff. It was an interesting situation that all factories, of course, had rubberized black paint over the glass of all the windows to stop the glass splinters doing the damage that they did. And then suddenly somebody said to Churchill, why are we doing all the power we're using on putting lights into factories and things like that during the daytime when there are no German aircraft left? Why are we doing it? We don't need it anymore. We don't need to be blacked out. So we better get all the paint off the windows so that we can use God's light during the day. So this was suddenly all over England. People, all the factory workers were suddenly said, get rid of all this black paint. To do that, you had to have, I can remember to this day, a tin of Pintoff was the name of the stuff, and a scraper and a brush. Now, the whole side of the factory was made of glass, and I was never late ever in my life on that thing. I loved the work, actually. And we had these three high-tiered ladders, and it was on the morning, it was 9 o'clock, and I was the first one to start climbing up the ladder. Now, the funny thing about it was that the hinges for the windows in which I was working were in the middle, and there was a clip at the top, and you opened the clip, and I got up there with my acid and the brush and the thing, which was very high up, I mean, say 20 feet up. And the first thing I did automatically, I don't even know why, but I just went with my finger to unclip the window. That was when it hit the factory next door, which was American Lincoln Motors. And it killed 30, 300 injured, blasted everybody around, terrific blast effect. And the only window on that side that wasn't shattered was mine, because I'd unclipped it and therefore just flicked open with a blast. No noise, never heard an explosion, but a huge rush of heat. I'd suddenly felt a huge rush of heat, and the next second I was flying, literally right across the factory. And on a sort of downward trajectory, I hit the wall and then slithered down the wall and landed on my knees, totally unhurt. So that was pretty lucky.
Amazing. You ended up, didn't you, in working in television in the 1950s, I think. So tell us a little bit about how you got from the perfume factory to there.
Well, I had to go in the army first. So the war had ended. It was 1947 when suddenly my call-up papers came. So my father came out and I went in.
This is National Service, is it?
Yes, National Service, conscript. And because I left school before I was 15 years old, I hadn't done school certificate or anything like that. So I just hurled into the army. Well, when they interviewed me, they said, "What do you want to be?" I said, "I want to be a fighter pilot." You see? And they said, "Oh, I see." Because we loved, they were our heroes, even in those days. Nobody was better in England than the fighter pilots, you know, the Spit and Hurricane pilots. And so I said that, "What did you do in mathematics in your school certificate?" I said, "Didn't take school certificate." "What do you mean you didn't take school certificate? You don't think you could go and be a pilot without a school certificate, do you?" And that was my first defeat. And then after that, I was... I said, "Well, if I've got to go in the army, then I'll go in the infantry, the hard end of it." And that's where I went into, and I found myself in Special Forces eventually. Broke into Dover Castle with a crew one time, which was quite a feat. Actually got right into Dover Castle. And there we are. So I became in the infantry. And then we were... So we were going to Hong Kong, and on the way there we were suddenly told there's an uprising in Malaysia and Singapore. So you're no longer going to Hong Kong, you're now going straight into action, get fit, land in Singapore, and you're going straight into the jungle.
So I suppose the 1940s were a time where Britain was still trying to hang on to its empire by its fingernails in a way.
Let me think before I answer that. I don't think we were hanging on, because, of course, India had made it perfectly clear that they wanted their independence, and everybody was waking up to independence and that they wanted their own country under their own control. Yes, but, I mean, the war was so all intent to win the war. I mean, we weren't really thinking at that time about whether or not South Africa or Canada or anybody else. I don't think it was a matter of daily conversation at all. I wouldn't say so. But it was after the war had ended and the great excitement, and I remember standing outside Buckingham Palace on that night with Winston Churchill on the balcony with the King. I mean, I was there. Wonderful experience to be there. Unbelievable, actually. And then it was gradually, it was, of course, the returning troops who decided that we had enough of Winston Churchill and all his antics, you know, and it's going to be a new era, and we're going to sort of take over. And that's when he lost the election, of course, probably absolutely correct. And so it was a totally new era. And I don't think really people were really thinking so much about the colonies and what was going to happen. The battle had been won. That's the main thing. With the help of the Americans, God knows, we couldn't have done it without them. And so it was a different age. Then gradually, because the troops had thrown out Churchill, then the control was being lost, and all these many, many countries decided that this was obviously the moment when they could assert their authority and try and, you know, get their own country for themselves.
Now, you talk about the Americans, but what about the Russians? Because they lost a lot more, didn't they, in terms of men?
Absolutely, the Russians. The Russian, totally different thing. I mean, for instance, in the Russian army, if you were in the front line, they had a totally different concept for fighting. they move their divisions, the fighting man only went forward for, say, 3 days. He was no food, very heavy overcoats. They had to sleep in the snow, no food, and they had their rifle and their ammunition, and they fought for 3 days. Then they were taken out, and the new lot came in, totally different to our way of doing it. I mean, tough and hard, fighting a most dreadfully difficult battle. So, I mean, their casualties were enormous by comparison. Enormous. Wonderful people.
That was author Barry Wynne. He was one of the people that started ABC Television, and his father helped win the El Alamein battle, as you were just hearing there. And that's the first of a three-part series, and we have more from Barry next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, I'm joined by Lawrence Harrowell. Lawrence is from Surrey, but you haven't spent much time in Surrey recently, Lawrence, have you?
No, that's right. I've been living in South America for the last 16 years, most of the time in Colombia, but also some of that time in Ecuador, in Bolivia and in Chile.
Sounds very exotic. What first drew you over to, it's a long way away, isn't it? Or 3,000 miles or so?
It
is indeed.
Completely
different culture and language and everything.
That's right. Well, I've always had a bit of an inclination to know about indigenous cultures. And then my older sister went out there before I did to an indigenous community in Colombia. And when she came back and told me all about her experience, I found it really interesting. So I took 3 months out of my GCSEs, I was 15 at that time.
Wow.
And went out and, I found that I sort of liked, you know, farming life in Colombia. And
did you go on your own?
I went with my mother. But she was only out there for a month. I was out there for 3 months the first time I went. I decided I really liked it, came back, finished my GCSEs, which didn't take me very long, and then went out to live.
Okay, what did you like about it?
Basically, out there, you can live kind of a simple life on the land. It's easy, do you know what I mean? Still, at this point, you know, you, in order to buy land, it's not so difficult as it is here. And you don't have to go into...
Especially Surrey.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have to go into industrial production, you know, tractors and all that. So that's something that attracted me quite a lot.
So you doing some sort of farming and working on the land. What's the difference between a Surrey farm and a Colombian farm?
Well, like I say, it's not so industrial, the method that I use out there. You know, you're not cultivating such a huge amount.
Are you cultivating drugs?
No.
It's the obvious question.
No, I mean, basically the project that I've worked on most is with an ecological community out there that we've basically got a variety of a lot of different things. And, you know, our main objective is to be self-sustainable ourselves, you know, to grow what we need to have the livestock to keep ourselves going, you know.
And now, as you say, an objective, is it possible to do that in Colombia? Be self-sustainable, to feed yourself and then be able to sell enough material, enough products to keep yourself going?
It's very hard work. It's not easy. And you've got to be prepared to live a very, very humble lifestyle. Definitely don't have luxury out there myself.
So what's the degrees of mechanisation in farming? How far does it go over in Colombia?
Well, it depends really what areas you're talking about, because there are areas that are huge flatlands and they are, you know, farmed industrially. There are big landlords in Colombia, people with a lot of land, like the ex-president Uribe, who's got, I don't know how many thousands of hectares of palm plantations and things like that.
Well, they seem to reward quite a lot of crooks with land,
right. Yeah,
as a reward. Even back in the English Civil War in Ireland, they gave loads of land in Northern Ireland, didn't they, to the soldiers who'd fought for Cromwell in Ireland. And so this is nothing new.
No.
But on your ecological community, how far did the mechanisation go? I mean, just sort of, were you using tractors and all that sort of thing?
No, not at all. Went as far as a rotavator, but it's not something we use very often. It's very... very steep terrain, so it's not easy to...
So mostly by hand?
Mostly by hand, mostly machete, a hoe, things like that. So yeah.
And what sort of balance between livestock and arable?
It's quite balanced, really. There's, you know, got sheep.
Llamas?
There are a couple of llamas, actually. Yeah,
One llama on its own is not much fun, is it?
No, yeah, we've got a couple.
Yeah, so. Did they spit at you? I know they're quite nasty.
Sometimes if they're in a bad mood, yeah. can happen.
A lot of llamas, I'm afraid, my experience of llamas is quite negative. They start getting annoyed with you. But anyway, look, one of the main reasons you liked it out there, as you said, is the indigenous people. What's the culture
That's right.
like?
Yeah, well, I mean, that sort of brings me a little bit to what I wanted to speak with you about today, Tony, which is about the Wadju indigenous of North Colombia. I mean, what attracts me a lot to indigenous culture is their kind of their outlook on life is very different to the Western outlook. You know, for a Western mentality, good living is often associated with material
big house, fast car,
all of that. Whereas the indigenous viewpoint is you're living good when you're living in harmony with all of the beings that surround you, whether that be humans, plants, or animals, you know.
Okay,
or
well, hang
Mother
on,
Nature
because
itself.
Immediately I have to say to you, what about livestock? Are you in harmony with a sheep or a cow that you're going to kill?
Yeah, well, to be honest, the indigenous, they don't have that exact kind of mentality of the modern day kind of vegetarian mentality. But I mean, it's a very hot subject. I wouldn't really want to go there, you know, okay. in general, because it's. People get
So being in harmony with beings around you, what does that mean exactly?
Well, it's all about knowing how to treat Mother Nature right, basically. I mean, where I was, as an example of how not to do it, there's this massive, one of the biggest open pit coal mines on Earth in La Guajira department in the north of Colombia, where these Wadju indigenous live. Now, this is causing a lot of devastation up there, a lot of contamination.
So is it also displacing indigenous people? A lot of these
oh,
projects
indeed.
Do, don't they?
Yeah, it has. There's been a lot of indigenous, you know, forced to leave their lands and given, you know, kind of smaller places, areas to live. So, yeah, and you know, it's in their ancestral territory. These indigenous people, these Wadju indigenous, an amazing indigenous culture. They were never subjugated by the Spanish, which you can't say for a lot of tribes in South America. They actually maintained an independent nation during the entire Spanish colony. But now, unfortunately, there's a lot of influences that are coming in and trying to sort of attack and take away from them
what,
that indomitable
like
spirit.
Coca-Cola?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you've got it. Coca-Cola.
McDonald's.
I mean, in my time teaching, I was teaching for a year.
Teaching English, yeah?
I was teaching English, yeah, as a foreign language there in a boarding school, because basically myself, if I want to go and know about a place, I've got to find work there out there because I haven't got funds, you know, to sort of support myself for a year. Or anything like that. So I was teaching out there in this boarding school, and I basically began to kind of open my eyes just to the amount of corruption all around. This boarding school was being used. It's called Siapana, the place where I was teaching, Siapana. 7 hours from the nearest town through the desert, you know, driving. So this place...
Wow, that's pretty remote.
...has basically got... it's being attacked on all different levels. There's a lot of state intervention. The actual powers, control mechanism within the boarding school is what kind of allows all of these influences to come. So basically the head teacher and her inner circle of teachers. Unfortunately, I found out because they present themselves to be very kind of saintly. They're all kind of very Catholic. But unfortunately... You know, it's not quite as they like to sort of present
themselves.
Well,
I mean, the Catholicism's been used as a Trojan horse, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and indeed, it was in that case. I'm not against...
It was in the original conquistadors.
Exactly, yeah, and it still is continuing to be used in that way. I mean, I'm not against... I consider myself Christian in that I follow Christ's teachings, and I value them very much. I think they've got a lot to teach
us. It'd
be
nice if the Pope, you know, did that.
Indeed,
the Catholic Church,
would be, yeah.
Especially when they were smuggling the Nazis out at the end of the Second World War, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah.
But maybe they should think about it, yeah, anyway. I mean, that's the Vatican, I suppose, revenue.
Yeah,
right,
but I mean, what they're really using that as is basically a tool for psychological domination of these, in this case, of these indigenous people. You know, unfortunately, I... found that out.
So in a way you've been a poacher turned gamekeeper, or maybe the other way around, gamekeeper turned poacher, because you've been inside
right.
the school. What did you see there?
Well, basically, I mean, one very concerning aspect that I was seeing there is that there's a well being built, which is part of a big government initiative to show that they're caring for La Guajira, which is the department, is the area. So their building is well in there, but on doing that, they basically got a military base within the boarding school, which is very concerning. I mean, it's very dangerous. You know, they say it's to do with building this well. It's a 465-metre deep well because there's a big drought for the last 5 years.
This is for water, yeah.
This is for water because there's a big drought, yeah. Their annual rains haven't come for the last 5 years. It's a semi-desert area, but now it's becoming a desert area. So basically, this well is being built, but under that pretext, they've basically got a military base in there. And I was observing the movements of these militars in and out, you know, day and night. And it's not just about building a well, you know, they're taking advantage of the place. And I even had conversations with some of them, which they kind of admitted, you know, they felt safer there than outside. And it's really bad for the kids.
The military.
Yeah, it's really bad for they felt safer, you know, inside. They felt it was a more relaxed ambient than being outside with the remote possibility they might have some attack from a guerrilla group or something. Mm-hmm. You know, they felt a bit safer in there, which is not very manly.
I mean, how does this fit in with the politics of Colombia? Because pretty much the only news I think we get in the UK about it is the drug war, the ceasefire with the FARC guerrillas, which seems to be going on and on and on, the negotiations. Apparently, we're going to have some sort of peace agreement in March this year, which never happened.
How does
what's going on at your school fit in with the wider political picture in the country?
Well, basically, I mean, one thing that's interesting in terms of the peace agreement is that basically what Santos, the Colombian president, is trying to achieve with that is he wants to open up Colombia and make it more attractive to these transnational companies for them to invest so that there's no guerrillas, you know, sort of hiding in the bushes about to attack their initiatives and their projects there. So, I mean, that opens also the doors a lot to companies like Strata. You know Strata? It's a mining company that's they're mining this Cerrejón mine, one of the biggest open pit coal mines in the world that's there. So it's quite concerning because basically, you know, the rights and justice for people like the Wadju indigenous is not something that's being negotiated in this agreement between the government and the FARC guerrillas.
One of the things I've always felt about Colombia, particularly. Yeah. Is that it's the country in South America which joins on to Central America.
That's
it's quite important strategically.
It's extremely
the US
important.
US have always wanted to control Colombia.
Oh, they have, and they do control it completely. It's one of the biggest strongholds of US
America. So the president of Colombia is pretty much a puppet of the US, is he?
Oh, totally. I mean, he passes any law basically that he's asked to pass. For example, there's a law called it's a resolution actually called the Resolution 9.70, which outlaws farmers to reproduce their own seed. Now it's all got to be bought certified seed, which in its majority is either genetically modified or highly hybridized, and usually from foreign companies, most of them US companies.
Like Monsanto or something
like
that.
That's right. So that's another thing. That's another aspect that affects the whole of the country and also the Wadju indigenous, because they can't cultivate their food like they used to when there used to be rain. So they're getting a lot of genetically modified grains and food shipped into them, which is another big attack on
them. Sounds horrendous. I mean, but you love the place.
Oh, I do indeed. I mean, it is. There's a lot of injustice going on there, but as a country, it's beautiful. You know, it's got all kinds of climates. It's actually the most biodiverse country per area in the world. Colombia is, and the same in terms of its country with most water in, you know, per area.
Not in that particular spot you were talking about, though.
Not at all. No, that's very dry. That
now, if I was to go onto the Foreign Office website, I'd probably find something saying, danger, don't go to Colombia.
That's right, yeah.
So what can you convince me to go?
Well, basically, as long as you stick to more or less to the tourist routes, or you're with someone who knows what they're doing, knows where they're going, you'll be fine. I've lived in Colombia probably for maybe 8 years altogether, and you know, I've encountered some hairy situations, but you know, I do live as most Colombians do, you know, because it's my home now. And that's also because I'm into activism. I'm into sort of like speaking out against genetically modified crops and, you know, telling people about those kind of things. So you do get into a little bit more danger doing that kind of work. But if you're just a tourist, you're not going to have a problem as long as you stick to the normal.
And if you get
routes
into the outback, is there a sort of culture of different sorts of music, dance, that kind of thing?
There is a culture. Oh, definitely. For example, like now we're talking a lot about the Wadju indigenous. They have their own kind of ancestral culture, amazing music, different traditional dances they've got. This is another thing that's under attack because via these boarding schools, basically they're all being weaned onto this kind of, you know, tacky kind of Western kind of music. Music that you probably wouldn't recognize the name of, reggaeton and things like that, but it's this basically kind of, you know, like rap style music and all this kind of stuff. So obviously these a lot of football kind of replacing their tradition. They've got traditional sports, indigenous sports and games.
Give us an example of one of those then.
One of them is similar actually to bowling, but instead of rolling a ball along the ground, you have to throw a stone to hit another stone. It
sounds like the French ball, maybe something a bit similar to that.
It's similar to that, yeah. That's about, yeah.
And so when are you planning to go back?
I'm going back in a couple of months' time, yeah. And I'm not 100% sure at this point whether I'll actually be going back to La Wajira. I certainly won't be received back as a teacher in that boarding school because I think I upset certain people in power there, you know, by talking different truths. Although I've found out there are a lot of people who share my opinions, but there's a lot of persecution and repression against those kind of ideas.
And is there anything you particularly want to share with us you don't think we've talked about so far that's like, you know, helping us to see what life's been like for you there?
I mean, one experience I would like to sort of talk about that I don't know if you know anything about the International Organization for Migration. It's an organization that, as far as I know, poses to be a humanitarian organization. And they turned up at our boarding school one day. And so, you know, lessons were interrupted. We were told that we'd had a three-day training by them. They give all the teachers a three-day training. And basically they were training us to do workshops for all of the children, all of the parents, and for the local Wadju community in general. To these workshops, information-gathering workshops, kind of, if I do a direct translation, kind of participatory investigation workshop with the parents, in which we had to get information on them, basically all of the information on them, what they do, how they live, what they think, their fears, their hopes, their weaknesses.
Now, the CIA were caught doing this over in Afghanistan, weren't they? They had medical teams apparently going around in Afghanistan offering vaccinations, but actually what they were doing was just intelligence gathering.
Well, exactly. That sounds about right. And it's a bit, it sounds a bit dodgy to me because over there, you know, not everyone's hooked up to Facebook. Not everyone's got internet. Most people don't. So it's an area that, well, we know, I think you probably know, Tony, that information is power. For them to get information on those people, they need those kind of supposedly humanitarian initiatives because we were told that that was all being done so that the IOM knew how best to channel its aid. Aid that it was offering the Wadju people, and this is aid that comes from USAID and other big transnational sort of capitalist companies.
And did they say to you, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about? Did they say that? That's the one they use, isn't it? Quite a lot. If you're yeah. saying, well, hang on, why do you need all this information? We say, well, if you've got nothing to hide.
Yeah, no. I mean, they were very slick about their whole presentation, very diplomatic about it all. And they did say at the beginning, kind of quickly, so hopefully maybe no one would hear them, that, you know, this is optional. You don't have to help with these. And I, at the end, stated my intention to not go along with their program. And I sort of explained a little bit why, which was... Maybe.
Sounds a bit scary to see. You go to somewhere that's totally unspoilt, and it's almost like you've got Babylon turning up, kind of doing an inventory of everything, a bit like the Doomsday Booker after the Norman invasion.
That's right. I mean, I really, you know, I mean, I'm not one of these people who's reads up a huge amount on conspiracy theories, but I have heard a little bit about the New World Order and everything, and I just thought, well, if there's a world government, these must be their agents, you know, because they present themselves as like the big solution, basically.
The NATO countries, basically. I mean, the Chinese seem to be kind of, and the Russians against them, but I mean, yeah, it sounds pretty horrific. But anyhow, but you still love the place and you're still going
Indeed.
Back.
I am, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And can you just give us an idea of whereabouts online or books or whatever we can have a look at to follow what's going on in Colombia keep in touch with what's going on over there?
Yeah, there's different groups. The Colombia Solidarity Campaign is one group that you can... check out what's going on. To be honest, I'll probably have to get back to you with more information because most of the information
Colombia
I read
Solidarity
is in Spanish, and that's not going to be much use to most listeners.
Can people who only speak English cope over there, really?
Well, like I say, if you're going as a tourist, you can. You know, Colombians in general are quite warm people to outsiders, you know, as opposed to other countries.
And is it cheap?
Reasonably cheap. It's reasonably cheap. Not the cheapest of countries in South America. It's reasonably cheap.
And drugs. This is a big thing with Colombia, isn't it? I mean, I sort of mentioned it earlier, but
yeah.
isn't it sort of everywhere?
Well, to be honest, I imagine it is. I'm not a person who ever pursued drugs very much. So I haven't, do you know what I mean? If you don't look for them, on reflection, yeah, you do get offered them every now and again, but I think you do in most places if you're walking through a big city or something.
Do in Bristol, actually. Yeah, if you right, walk yeah. in some places in Bristol, you may well be.
But there are obviously famous drug routes there, but there's not a huge cocaine culture amongst normal people in Colombia. You know, it's more the foreigners that go there, as far as I know.
In a way, I'm being a sort of a bit hypocritical, aren't I? I'm kind of tainting Colombia with the usual nonsense, whereas you've actually had the real experience and you're telling me, no, actually drugs is not everywhere, although most people here, I would imagine, would think they are.
Yeah, you'd imagine that all Colombians are cocaine addicts, but yeah, that's not the case. That's not the case at all.
Well, Lawrence Harrowell, it's been fascinating hearing all about your trip over there and your visit and your love of the country. Maybe you can either do a Skype interview or something when you're over there tell us about when you're next back in the UK. How long do you plan to stay over there for all this time? Any idea?
I have no idea. Last time I was over for 7 years. I didn't come back, for 7 years. So who knows this time how long it'll
That's it. Goodbye, Lawrence.
Thank
anyway.
You so much, Tony. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Yeah, cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Joined now by a former lecturer at the University of the West of England, Jackie Cannon. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Understand your book just coming out.
Yes.
About Cuba. Why Cuba?
If you remember, I appeared on another programme of yours on last May, and I was talking about having a kind of romance story in a political context as well, where my husband's Cuban. It was a place I wanted to go for years and didn't actually go to till 2010, partly because I refused to go to Cuba as a tourist. I wanted to meet people. Certainly didn't expect to come back with a husband, but I didn't come back with a husband, but we stayed in touch and we actually got married the following year.
So your book about Cuba, what's it called?
It's called Cuba, One Moment in Time. And I started writing it in January of 2015. And if you remember the agreement or announcement between Raul Castro and President Obama was in December of 2014. And I was in Cuba with my husband at the time, and just one day I woke up and thought, I'm experiencing, witnessing, living a hugely historical moment. And I wanted to record it in some way or another. And so I started writing a book, which took me longer than I expected or wanted, because things kept changing. In the whole of 2015, there's another change and there's another change, and even in 2016, just before Obama's visit to Cuba in March, which I was privileged to witnessed by, I was in Cuba at the time.
But will the United States ever really tolerate a kind of communist state on its doorstep? Because that was the problem in the 60s, wasn't it? They didn't want it.
They didn't want it.
So what's changed? Has things really changed?
I would say things haven't really changed in a sense, because if you actually look at what President Obama's saying and what he said ever since the announcement in December 2014, what he was saying in March 2016, and at every moment since, he has focused a lot on civil society and people-to-people exchanges and wanting to encourage autonomy, if you like. There's a new group of, if you like, self-employed workers, which the U.S. Administration is calling entrepreneurs, who are entrepreneurs, but they're very much focusing on that. But their intention to not tolerate the Cuban government, if you really study what they've said, there isn't an acceptance of the Cuban government. There is a willingness to relate people to people and promote the US style of autonomy.
I wonder, is there McDonald's springing up across Cuba at the moment?
We were at the theatre last year, and the theatre in Cuba, and it was a very satirical play. I can't even remember what it was called, but they made a comment about how things were changing, and they said, yes, there'll be a committee for the defense of the revolution in Florida, and there'll be a Starbucks on the Rampa, which is, you know, 23rd Street, a very distinctive street in Havana. So it's like the Cubans are kind of laughing about that, I think, as a possibility. It's not going to happen anytime soon.
Okay, but you're talking about this, your book, Cuba, One Moment in Time. Next Friday, that's the 29th, part of the Spanish Circle at St. Bartholomew's Church Hall, St. Andrew's. Can you tell us what's going to be going on and what time it starts?
So that starts 7:30 for an 8 o'clock start, actually. And the focus of that will be, well, I'm hoping that my book will be actually out by then or available for sale. But that wasn't why it was organised. It's kind of serendipitous, because this was organised last August, I think it was scheduled, the talk. The main focus of the talk is going to be, it's with my husband, actually, because when I was in Cuba for Obama's visit in March, and you can't forget the Rolling Stones concert as well, which also happened. But when I was there, what I was aware of was that the international press, if you like, Western press, was focusing very much on what Obama was saying, not very much on what President Castro was saying. What the Cuban press then did was focused more on what Obama didn't say. And so that is essentially what we're going to be talking about next week.
Because you're going to be talking about what Obama didn't say. Well, what didn't he say?
Well, there were a number of things. And I'll just say that while I was there, we actually made some video clips of my husband highlighting the different aspects that were being raised by Cuban press. One of the things he didn't say, the Cuban people and the government and the press picked up on, was when he delivered his speech to the Cuban civil society on the Tuesday, 22nd, I think, it was hours after the bomb attacks in Brussels. And, of course, he condemned acts of terrorism and aggression. But Cubans were actually hoping that he'd say something about, I think it was a vain hope personally, but they would have liked him to say something about, yeah, we're sorry we've been attacking Cuba all these years with all these subversive actions and
how many attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro is it?
Well, I'm not sure. I have no idea. There's many that are known about.
Yeah.
And I was reading today about his, he did one of the closing speeches of the 7th Party Congress this week. Fidel Castro came out and he didn't actually meet Obama, but he's come out for the 7th Party Congress. And he's saying, well, they didn't actually get the biological solution they wanted. So he's not dead yet. He's nearly 90, but he's apparently not dead yet.
Well, there's other things like big American corporations that want to sell their seeds and things like that, this kind of genetic modified seeds where you have to keep going back to the seed company. You're not allowed to keep your own seeds, that kind of thing. Now, that is Cuba going to go down that road?
One of the things that Cuba had to do after they lost their trade with the Eastern Bloc countries after the fall of the Berlin Wall is they became very autonomous in terms of their agricultural production, and particularly in urban areas, it's been copied. Now,
sort of dig for victory program in a way, a bit like Britain surviving through the Second World War.
Yeah, very much, you know, it's like we're alone here and we've got to feed ourselves.
And we can and we will,
and they have done that. But interestingly, the whole area of the scientific and drugs world, one of the first vaccines, Cuba has a vaccine, and I can't remember the name of it, the Americans want to buy. It's cancer, lung cancer vaccine, Simavex, I think it's called. So that's one of the things that, you know, I'm not quite sure how that's going to work, because I don't know if the Americans want to buy the patents. I'm not clear on the level of involvement, but they want to produce it. Cuba, as you know, their health and education sectors are hugely, they're a fundamental aspect of the socialist ideology. And so one of the things that was said as a response to some of the things that President Obama said was, yeah, that's great, promoting people who are, you know, offering taxi rides and private restaurants and things. But actually, we still need the innovation and the medical internationalism, and we're still going to do all those things. So I don't think Cuba will be rushing to start importing things. The things that they want, and funnily enough, the week before Obama's visit, they started announcing, they said it was the case that no ship that docked in a Cuban port could actually dock in a US port for 6 months afterwards from anywhere in the world. That has been lifted.
Well, that's a sort of trade barrier, isn't it?
It is.
Sanctions type thing that's done, yeah.
Yeah, but what they've said, what it seems, or some of the interpretations.
You know, if I was a captain or whatever, I'd go to one of the other Caribbean islands and ship off stuff there, and then, you know, then you could have a shuttle service backwards and forwards to Cuba, couldn't you?
Yes, that would probably be quite popular.
Yes, well, maybe I'll miss my chance now, though, because they've dropped the sanctions anyway. But that's good, isn't it?
Well, are you saying the US has dropped the sanctions?
Well, that's what you've just said, isn't it? That they've stopped doing
this
to those. Ah, right. So there's a whole load of other ones they haven't dropped.
There's a whole load of other ones that
are still in place.
Yes, yes. So that I will is something that I'll also be mentioning when I speak at the Bristol Spanish.
Do you want to just remind us where and when it's all taking place again?
Yes, it's on Friday the 29th of April. It's at St. Bartholomew's Church in St. Andrews. And the postcode is BS6 5BZ. and we'll be starting about 8 o'clock. You know, there is an admission fee of £3.50, I believe, and £2.50 for students. And everyone who's got an interest in Cuba is welcome to come. There will be some extracts in Spanish, and I can paraphrase those in English. I plan to do that anyway, so nothing to worry about, and look forward to seeing you there.
Okay, Jackie Cannon, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, and it's been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Lawrence Harrowell from Colombia, Jackie Cannon from Cuba and Barry Wynn, who lives nowadays in Cyprus. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.